This podcast is recorded on stolen and unceded Aboriginal land.
We acknowledge the First Nations and elders of this country and join their calls for justice.
All right, let's dive into the Dutton Archives. This to me is my favourite moment, I think, in Australian political history. It's also the dumbest moment in Australian political history. Do you remember, Kristen, when Peter Dutton was asked whether the hip-hop artist Macklemore should perform his smash hit song, Same Love, at the AFL Grand Final? Do you remember this?
I wish I didn't remember it, to be honest. It was really hard to grasp where he found that particular line. I mean, did it just come up, or is it something he had prepared earlier, thinking about the situation of free speech and the football?
Clearly, in the clip, he talked about it. And this is, again, just a reminder of how insane this country was during the marriage equality plebiscite. And, you know, it was just dumbness left, right and center. Remember that guy that, like, punched Tony Abbott or whatever? Like, it was crazy. And clearly Dutton had made his thoughts clear about this particular issue and was then asked. And he says, no, because any political activities at sporting events is completely unacceptable. Unacceptable is what he said, which is incredible, of course. People hate their politics and their sport mixing, except for all the times that it does. Except when you have the army, you know, do a fucking flyover for the Super Bowl. That's fine. That's not politics. And then asked, well, what about free speech? And he said, if you believed in free speech, maybe you should have another song that's against marriage equality played at the same time for balance.
Do you think Macklemore should perform Same Love at the NRL Grand Final?
No, I don't. I've been clear about that. I think political statements at sporting events is unacceptable. I think it's...
But what about free speech?
Well, I'm very much into free speech, but if you're into free speech, then presumably there'd be two songs played, one in favour of gay marriage and one against gay marriage, if that's the proposition.
So I have a question for you. What is your favourite song that's against marriage equality?
I know. Oh, my God. It's hard.
I just wanted him to be asked. I just wish a journalist had said.
Yeah, name one song.
Find the most bigoted song and make sure that that person is invited. I mean, yeah. I'm sure they could have come up with them, but put him on the spot.
I mean, to be fair, you could probably get Eminem to do some of his old homophobic shit, and then that probably would have balanced it out.
I'm not suggesting there's any, like, you know, scarcity of material, but I just wish, I wish he had been asked. What does Dutton listen to?
What does he listen to? Oh, fucking freak.
Talk about the Greens, that bunch of idiots.
The Greens are nuttier than they have ever been.
They are snake oil salesmen.
Far more extreme than Clive Palmer or One Nation.
I'm suggesting they hate our society.
Frankly, I've always found the Greens to be a real serious danger to Australia.
Serious danger to Australia.
All right. Hi, everyone. It's a serious danger. This is a podcast about green politics in Australia. It is not an official Greens Party podcast. We are independent. My name is Tom Ballard, and this show is made possible with the help of the Green Institute and produced by Michael the Griff Griffin. Thank you for joining us. As we mentioned last week, Emerald Moon is off on holidays, taking a very well-deserving break after winning the 2022 federal election. And over the next couple of weeks, we're going to have a bunch of special guest co-hosts joining me on the show. And kicking things off, I am so stoked that she agreed to do this with us. She's an anti-poverty campaigner who's worked with the Australian Unemployed Workers Union. She now works with the Anti-Poverty Centre. She's a former National Greens secretary, and she's a serious danger listener, Kristen O'Connell. Hello.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me. It's delightful to come back a little bit towards Greens territory for a brief visit.
Little bit. You were sort of heavily involved with the party. You've worked on certain campaigns every now and again, but you've been stepping away to focus entirely on anti-poverty. And so you can't be seen hanging out with such tree Tories as us here in the Greens. Is that right?
Yeah. Yes, that's right. And also stepping away to work on anti-poverty has had far greater effect on Greens policy around welfare than it did when I was National Secretary. So I've found it easier.
Yeah, really?
Yeah. I remember before the 2019 election, when we were doing the platform in 2018, we got to this policy, we were there ready to sign it off. And I just quickly looked at the numbers and I was like, hey, the poverty line is this and the $75 a week is like a lot lower than that. And no one had thought of that up to that point. It had gone through the whole Greens process. from right up from the grassroots up to the top level, which is really indicative. Now, I wasn't on welfare at the time. I had a really good job. It was just something that I had grown up on welfare, and I could not imagine a situation where it would be acceptable to advocate for, you know, a rate below the poverty line. So I was quickly Googling it on my phone. I was like, this isn't right. And I lost that argument, but here we are 3 years later with a guaranteed livable income. So I feel like leaving was a good choice.
Yeah, you left the party and we got better. So what does that say about you?
Yeah, that's right. I was holding everyone back.
God damn it. No, you're doing amazing work within and outside the party, and we appreciate that. And yes, thank fuck that the Greens have moved into a position, just the most basic minimum, the idea that people shouldn't be living in poverty. Thumbs up to
it's
that.
It's made it much harder to criticise the Greens too, which is really difficult for me.
Oh, no. Well, you're going to have to work hard. We encourage that here at Serious Danger. We will talk more about the freakishness of Peter Dutton, what it means for him to become the leader of the Liberal Party, as well as the new leader of the Nationals. That is coming up. But, yeah, we really want to keep picking through the entrails of the 2022 federal election, talk about this new government that has arrived, our new Labor overlords, new cabinet, same as the old cabinet. And because we've got Kristen here, obviously we'll be able to sort of, you know, tackle this from an anti-poverty perspective and sort of think about what will happen for the millions of people in this country who live below the poverty line and whether there's much hope there to hang on to. You're going to bum everyone out, you were telling me beforehand. In my view, Emerald is like quite a realist, and but in your view, she's like living off of fantasy land and she needs to like wake up to herself. Be more cynical like you.
I am relieved that there aren't more people who are as depressing as me around, but every time I get off the phone to a journalist or someone like that, the final sound they sort of make before they close the conversation is,
oh boy.
And I just always say, I'm so sorry. This is every time I talk to someone, the conclusion is that because things are very grim. And unfortunately, they're not looking any better despite everyone's high hopes.
Okay. All right. Okay. Well, let me just revel a little bit in some victories of happy times. Then we'll get depressed together. Quick update, of course, since the recording of our last episode, Stephen Bates officially won the seat of Brisbane. Congratulations, Stephen. That brings us up to a total of four lower house seats in this next parliament, which is very exciting. Congrats, Stephen Bates. Again, retail worker, member of the RAFU union. He has to finish his shifts. There was quite a bit of media attention about the fact he has to finish his shifts at Apple in Brisbane before he takes up his new job in the parliament, which is pretty crazy. He's renting. If you want to listen to him and me and Elizabeth Watson-Brown have a chat on the show, we did a Meet the Candidate special with them. Check out the archives there to have a listen to that. McNamara has been officially called for Labor. Okay, and they got onto that very quick. The ABC said that they didn't think there was a chance the Greens could get up there, and they've moved forward. Josh Burns has gone to Parliament and has been given some kind of minor portfolio, I think. I have heard talk that there may be some kind of recount scenario in McNamara. I don't know. I don't know too much about it, and I don't know how any of that system works. But anyway, there is a small chance. Regardless, shout-outs once again to Steph Hodgins-May, third-time candidate, growing the vote, got a 5% swing to her, I think, in the election. Surely, with the power of the people, McNamara will go green at the next election at the very least.
And disillusionment with the Labor Party, it always helps.
Yes. Look, hey, get Labor into government. It's a surefire way to get people disappointed. Real toot sweet. Also, I just wanted to read a little bit of this. There's been lots of like good pieces, I think, you know, going through the result and talking about the campaign. And there was a great one from Lech Blain in the Monthly called Teal and Loathing. And Lech Blain is a working class dude who's like, I think, a very good writer and talks about politics from the ground up and talks to ordinary working people across the political spectrum and tries to find out what's going on inside their heads and where they're coming from. Did you read this piece, Kristen?
I did, yeah. And it was good. It kind of was on my level of being really depressed with how people are feeling about the state of the country. And, you know, it really reflects what a lot of people, including myself, have been saying for a long time, that people hate politicians and yet they're still offering nothing. And it was really one of the other grim things about it was how many folks were repeating the line that we have debt and we need to pay down the debt. And this narrative is not based in fact, really. And it's so dominant across so many types of media that people have internalized it. And so that makes it very easy for powerful people to say that less powerful people shouldn't be able to afford to live.
We'd love to help them, but we can't. The debt.
The tax cuts.
And these are like homeless people. These are people who are, you know, living on the breadline, living paycheck to paycheck, trying to put their life together, whose concerns, one of the concerns they seriously list is the state of the national debt. You're right. That was extremely depressing. But there were these other little insights into, particularly in Brisbane, about the green strategy that I thought was worth sort of just highlighting. I'll read you this. Paul Hilton is a 62-year-old father of three with a shaved head. Semi-retired, he lives with his wife Sharon in an apartment next to Brisbane's Story Bridge. He's packing up a sleek Ford Ranger for a long weekend of camping on the scenic rim. "I love Johnny Howard," he says. "He did a ton of good stuff." Hilton's grandfather, also named Paul Hilton, was a rural Labor MP in the Hanlon and Gare state governments. His father was a trade unionist. Paul Hilton III started an accounting firm in Toowoomba. He has strayed away from the Labor stable. A bona fide swinging voter, he switched to Howard in 1996. He voted One Nation in the Senate 2 years later. "I didn't agree with her on everything," he says, "but at least she wasn't scripted." Hilton might live in the inner city, but he's a long, long way from woke. He sits on four company boards and is the chairman of the Withcott Group, an agricultural business. His vote should be safe as a house for the Liberal National Party. But the words Scott Morrison elicit visceral indignation. "I hate the fuckwit," he says.
Yes, Paul.
yes. Go, Paul. Comrade Preach. Paul. But Leck Blaine goes on to say that this guy lives in Griffith, Terry Butler's old seat. "And I ask Hilton who he will be voting for, anticipating that he will switch back to his grandfather's party. Mate, I'll be voting for the Greens," he says, without skipping a beat. "This young bloke," Max Chandler Mather, "seems pretty good. And I'm just sick of the same old shit." Hilton's wife and three sons will also vote for the Greens. This isn't some irrational protest voter. He sees pros and cons in the Liberals and Labor. Quite simply, the Greens are the party that best represents his position on climate change. And for a Howard-loving accountant, he is shockingly receptive to economic redistribution. "Uni degrees should be free, like they were for me," he says, "and dental should be part of Medicare, but Labor is too chicken to do it."
Tree Tories are real. Paul is a tree Tory.
Well, but then maybe not so – well, I mean, obviously, I'm sure there's lots of things that you and I would disagree with Paul about, but again, like these aren't just people whose climate change is the only thing they care about. I don't think you can easily – tack on the teal phenomenon into some of these seats and the policy platform that the Greens were running on. I mean, these are like economic reasons. Leck Blaine also talks to Dylan Rowe. He's 31. He's a Maori dude. He grew up in public housing in Gladstone in a coal mining hub. His dad was a criminal. It was a petty thief, says Rowe, according, like those are his own words. And he's now a disability support worker. He switched to the Greens in 2019. And he just feels that white Labor politicians too often cater to the lowest common denominator on race. So on the racial offering, he's like sees Labor for the racist that they are. And he says he's worried about climate change but doesn't list it in his top three policy issues. He's voting Greens for economic reasons. He wants to see something done about the disability sector. His rugby union playing groomsman, is also voting for the Greens at this election and rejects the idea that working class people can't be attracted to what the Greens are fighting for. "I'm no jet ski buying liberal voting coal miner," he says, "but getting covered in other people's shit in his job seems pretty working class to me, bro." Encouraging, right? No?
Yeah, and I think it's really nice to see someone who grew up in public housing who still cares about those issues because obviously at the moment we have a prime minister who likes to talk an awful lot about what that means and how working class he is, although he's been a professional politician for three decades now. So, yeah, go Brisbane. I'm from Brisbane. It was nice to see that change. Unfortunately, where I grew up is still deeply, deeply conservative and went very hard for the Liberals. But it's nice to see parts of that city starting to think more deeply. And it's obviously there's been a lot of hard work that's gone into that. Yeah. But it also shows, particularly I think Paul's example, that if people get a chance to think about practicalities of what you're saying, they do agree. Because a lot of it is actually, you know, there's a lot of talk of common sense. And I think there might have been a note in that article about common sense. But a lot of this stuff is common sense. People need to be able to afford to live. We need the planet not to collapse. You know, these are not complicated ideas, but we do have like a dominant media narrative, again, that just undermines them and has undermined them for decades to the point where people have really absorbed messaging that isn't common sense at all.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, people often say that ideology you know, you're winning if your ideology is seen as a level of common sense. And that's obviously a battle within political rhetoric, right, to sort of say that you obviously represent the sensible centre and what you're talking about makes total sense. So sign up to our well, it's not even ideology. With us, it just makes sense. We're just offering sensible solutions with practical outcomes. Now, of course, everyone and his dog on the political spectrum will claim that what they're arguing for is common sense. But we're actually correct. We're the right ones, right?
I mean, you could argue that, like, you know, ideology has been – well, ideology has been turned into a dirty word, which has been a very good way of, like, pushing this idea of common sense, is that ideology is illogical and, like, thinking through problems and understanding power is illogical. And yes, that's really where we've got to, is that people don't seem to think much about how these people in power are using that power anymore. So I don't know. It was, as I said, heartening.
And what could
to
be
read.
Done with that power? What, like, yeah, all what the things that done? We could have? Why things better things are possible, but we do not get better things because of the way that power and the economy is shaped. Yeah, that's why.
Yeah. Well, better things are possible is clearly great messaging because, again, Labor adopted a better future as their slogan. Yes. And it's, again, been extremely frustrating to see them constantly talk about a better future for all of us and yes. then specifically refer to working families time and again. Yes. It just right. won't end every time. I just...
They're going to take a cost of living lens to the new budget or whatever. And we're going to make sure that people who are struggling aren't falling behind, unless, of course, you are unemployed or on some kind of fixed income from the government.
Up in the morning and after school, mother says there'll be no work next year. Qualifications, what's the golden rule? And now just pieces of paper.
Let's talk about that. I mean, how did you see the campaign leading up to Election Day and the subsequent result from the kind of work you do from an anti-poverty campaigner? How would you sort of what score out of 10 would you give the past couple of months or so in terms of that issue and caring about what you do?
I'm not sure I can give it a score. I mean, zero, like it's always okay. zero. But, you know, you're either going to end up with a government that won't raise payments or a government that won't raise payments. So that's kind of the calculus. And so a couple of months ago, I was kind of thinking, what is our strategy here? And very fortunate that at the Anti-Poverty Centre, we have a bunch of really brilliant members who we got together and talked about election strategy and realised there is a very slim chance of minority government. They're not common, but it's kind of our only pathway to potential change. So let's just think through how we could potentially gear our campaign around that. So we made our priority to target independents and minor parties. Specifically, obviously, the Greens have got a good policy. So we wanted to try and get independents to understand why it was really important and get all minor parties and independents to put this as a relatively high or the highest priority for them in negotiating with an incoming government if there was a minority parliament. Now, we did that knowing that it wasn't likely, but that was really, we felt, the most practical thing we could do. So we had, you know, a tiny win in that eventually the Greens did include livable income guarantee, their policy, in the priorities that they would push for. And we also were, you know, we had some good engagement from some of the independents who've been elected, and we're hoping to speak more to them. But, you know, I'm very cynical about it. I don't want people to get too depressed, but I don't think we have a good chance of getting a payment increase over the next 3 years. So we've also been thinking about a lot of other parts of the system, because people who aren't on payments might not realize there's just so many hoops you have to jump through just to keep a payment that's half the poverty line. There's a possibility that we might be able to get Labor to shift on some of those things. And they did promise one change to Social Security, which was too hard to know their position. They haven't been very clear. At one point, they did say they would abolish compulsory income control, where the government dictates what you can spend money on and where you can spend it.
This is the cashless debit card, right?
Yeah. And so now a priority for us, right, is making sure they deliver on that and trying to get rid of or soften some of the really punitive parts of the activity requirements you have to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Talk me through that moment. I can't remember when it was. It must have been during the election or maybe, no, it must have been during when we found out, I guess, through Andrew Lee's sort of doing some event and basically saying that we have no plans to conduct a review into the level of payment for JobSeeker. This was the big chat in 2019. Labor's going to do a review. They're going to do a review. It's going to be great. They're going to do a review. They're going to look at the whole social security system. They won't commit to increasing it. Or that Bill Shorten would say things like, well, we're not going to lower it. So it was the review was a big policy in 2019. And then during this election campaign, we found out that, no, we won't even be doing that. They have no plans whatsoever as a party to review the level of job seeker payments or the various payments that we talked about as part of Social Security. I mean, were you surprised by that? Did you assume that was the case anyway? Or how'd you feel about that?
I just want to highlight my favorite quote, which was Albanese saying, "We didn't drop our plan to review job seeker because we didn't have one." And a lot of this was in defense after we started attacking
your side. This.
It was a bit of a schmuzzle, right? Because on the Sunday morning, it was during the election campaign, immediately after the budget, Richard Miles went on Insiders and actually basically said, "We will raise it." But there were some weasel words in there, and I very cynically said, "I'm not sure this will raise it." And a lot of people who pay a lot of attention to the welfare space thought, no, he's said it. That's a big deal. And the following day, the Labor Party was clearly in damage control. Now, it was the Australian Council of Social Services post-budget event where they chose to confirm that they will not be doing anything for people on the lowest incomes. I mean, to get up. And honestly, we have one of the reasons we established the Anti-Poverty Centre is because there are just so many deep problems with big, corporate charities like ACOS and the way they approach their work. And it is all about being in the room and making sure they maintain these connections with politicians who haven't shown that they will do anything to help people and they refuse to oppose them strongly. And I think this was actually the perfect encapsulation of that, where he felt comfortable turning up to a room full of organisations that advocate for or provide direct services to people who are in poverty to say, we will do nothing. We're committed to doing nothing. And then that on top of the unemployment rate gap.
And we will not disappoint you on that. I make a commitment today to not do anything.
Yeah. And so, I mean, the other thing just around the whole thing actually then just kicked off a conversation about a review that would be completely pointless. And as was, pointed out during the last election, there had just been an inquiry into the rate of New Start. We just had a report from the Senate, from a Senate inquiry about disability support pension. I'm a disability support pensioner. Every review that's been done, and there have been lots of them, has shown that these rates are inadequate. There is no politician in this country that does not fully understand that people can't live on these rates. They're not not acting because they don't know and we just need to educate them more. They're not acting because they don't care and because they are making political choices to leave people in poverty because they prefer to help people who are doing great.
Yeah, Jesus Christ. Well, the certainty,
it's
really important.
You're doing the journo thing.
you are a bummer, man.
Oh, God.
Well, and the pivot seems to be that they get it now, and that, and I think, and I know this is important to you, and let's get into this now. I mean, it's almost worse to have these multi-billionaire politicians stand up and say, "Look, I get it. It must be really tough." It's Albanese literally said, "Jobs, it's way less than I earn, so I do earn more than people living below the poverty line.
Way less than my meal allowance when I go to Canberra.
It's less than my exactly." To trot out this faux sympathy and refuse to do anything about it and to not actually connect any of these lovely words of rhetoric, nobody left behind, nobody held back, we're on your side, a better future for everyone, blah, 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 blah. And then you get down, the rubber hits the road and there's nothing. There's nothing there. There is a willingness and, as you say, a political choice to allow people to continue to live in poverty in this country, one of the richest countries in the entire world. And the Anti-Poverty Centre put out a great statement on this, telling him to pull his fucking head in and stop wheeling out the story of his mother and his tough upbringing if he's not going to connect that to any kind of action for people who find themselves in that same situation today, right? This is, I assume, a massive bugbear of yours and something that you guys really want to highlight, that he can't just keep using this, poverty porn, this kind of, this very cynical deployment of his own personal story. Now that he's in the most powerful position in the country to do something about it, refuses to do so.
Yeah, it's been really sickening. I obviously talked to unemployed people and people relying on welfare and people who can't get welfare but need it every day. And everyone throughout the election was asking me, like, you know, there was, even for people who are used to being beaten down and don't have high expectations, there was this little bit of optimism and hope because he kept talking about this story. And there were a lot of people who do not pay as much attention as a lot of folks I support, who were only hearing those top line messages, who genuinely believe, despite the fact that he has consistently said they will do nothing. They're like, but of course he will, because how, you know, he understands. He understands. He doesn't understand. When he grew up, the public housing that he got was inherited. You know, his mother's public housing was inherited from her parents because that's the way public housing used to work. You had housing security when you lived in public housing. Where he grew up, which is where I live just down the road from what was public housing when Anthony Albanese grew up, and is now beautiful apartments. There was a massive expansion of public housing here in Glebe, implemented by one of Albanese's apparent heroes, Tom Uren. And, you know, his mum was on the DSP at a time when it, or, you know, what was the precursor to the DSP, at a time when it was basically at the poverty line that was determined through the Henderson inquiry in the early 70s. So there's just nothing comparable about his experience. I'd also add that he went to private schools the whole way through, straight into Sydney Uni, straight into a job as a staffer, has never worked a day in his life in a real job.
I think he was a banker for a short period of time. Didn't he work at a bank?
It sounds like he couldn't hack working at a bank because it didn't last very long. And I would argue that that is not a real job. Again, when you're going to cosplay as working class, you're going to do all of this rhetoric about being working class. He's never actually been a worker that could in any way fall into that category. So, yeah, it is really, it's been quite crushing for a lot of people. But my bigger concern and what is far more worrying to me, because I hear from people who are experiencing suicidal ideation and the urge to self-harm very often because of the state of living on welfare. And I'm very worried about now this sense of hope that he has engendered in people when they realize nothing's going to come of it. What that's going to do to people's mental health. It is a material outcome. He just sees it as politics and words, and it's all about winning. And he genuinely believes it, right? He believes he is better, and he believes he does understand because of that very like limited exposure to what it's like to have to rely on social security. But he is just so disconnected. And yeah, I'm very afraid. I'm afraid.
It's using that story too as not as a critique of capitalism, of the society in which we live. Like these log cabin stories, these hard dud mind stories are actually wheeled out to see like, hey, I survived through adversity, right? Like I overcame these difficulties and yeah, life's tough, but you got to believe in yourself and you got to reach for the stars and then you can overcome these problems, as opposed to saying it was fucked up that my mum lived, even though her circumstances were better than people who are on DSP now, you know, because of a bunch of, because the social democratic order hadn't crumbled as much when I was raising as a kid, but rather to point to that as like, this is unacceptable. And in a rich country like ours, nobody should be living the way my mum does or the way that people on DSP do now. It's more this kind of just this mythic story, building up your own personal story to send a signal to other people, you know, broadly voters that Labor wants to win over, saying, you know, I've been there and I'm like you. I'm not going to do anything now that I have this power to sort of change those material conditions for people. That's not I'm not really interested in that. But just you should know this story about how tough it was for me so that you can relate to me more and then vote number one Labor, right?
You too can be a person of colour who pulls yourself up by your bootstraps and becomes the Prime Minister. And I am fucking Sicilian and I am so furious about that as well. I know that is a minor one. But also, he went to the fucking Italian club, and I was like, all you have is a surname. I don't have my surname, but I have my culture. And I was just like, shut up. My God, you are a straight white man in a world that was built for you. And it's not just, you know, sort of what you were saying around there's no critique of capitalism there. He has actively dismantled the system that was there to support him when he was growing up. And another huge factor is the number of people who are on JobSeeker who are disabled is extraordinary now. And that's because of changes the Labor government brought in 2011. So it's not just a case of inertia. We're not going to do anything to fix it. It's a case of them actively seeking and putting this in their media statements at the time to find budget savings. So they were like, hey, here's a budget saving. We could just make sure disabled people are getting a much lower payment. And it is really hard. It's a difficult one to navigate because I don't think no matter how able-bodied or anything about your circumstances, whether you grew up wealthy, whatever it is, everyone should be entitled to a social security payment that is not conditional on doing activities and that is above the poverty line. Everyone should be entitled to that. But, you know, there is this idea in the public mind and in politicians' mind that disabled people are especially deserving and that we we talk about the NDIS, which only 12% of disabled people are able to access. Again, I'm very fortunate to be one of those people, which makes my DSP slightly more livable. But they are the ones who are causing these policies to be so dire, so abysmal. They're creating disability with how bad JobSeeker is, and they're harming people and making disabilities worse for people who already have one. And then, you know, those of us who are on the DSP can't really afford to live either in lots of cases. So, yeah, I think the fact that he's been able to hold this cognitive dissonance for so long, I don't see much hope for his time.
But Billy Bragg says that he's good. And Billy Bragg tweeted that Anthony Albanese has a socialism of the heart.
Billy Bragg was already probo, but like the song that he shared and Jeremy Poxon, who I get to work with on lots of cool anti-poverty activism, shared it and said, this is a song about being thrown on the scrap heap as an unemployed person.
Yes. So this is a song that Albanese quoted in his victory speech, was it?
I don't know specifically because I couldn't stomach watching Albanese's victory speech. but that's what Bragg shared.
Just because you're going forwards doesn't mean I'm going backwards.
Like the disconnect. And also just don't comment on politics so far away if you claim to have a class angle and you don't understand anything about what is going on in this country. Like clearly he's just bought into the PR of Australia that it's this like beautiful place to live and everyone's got, you know, nice things. I mean, austerity in the UK and the state of the UK welfare system is possibly even worse than ours. But yeah, it's just frustrating. So much bullshit. It's just so much bullshit. It's really, sometimes you're buried under it.
Sure. I mean, look, I love Billy Bragg. I will always love Billy Bragg. I think he's a nice old leftist man who has written some beautiful songs over the years. He met Albo in the 90s when he probably was actually or at least espoused actual socialism.
Again,
and actually
cosplaying.
Had
really good at it.
good take of the system. Who, yes, as you say, is probably not across all the details as to how the Labor Party today basically resembles, you know, Tony Blair's New Labor that he despised as well. But yeah, he mentioned a song and Jeremy pointed out the lyrics of that song are about exactly unemployed people being thrown onto the scrap heap. And of course, that is exactly what the Albanese government is doing.
Without you, I just don't seem to have any future. So won't you please, please, please come back, Margaret Thatcher.
In the Anti-Poverty Centre statement, you also write, while Anthony Albanese has shown no interest in supporting people on welfare the community has, the polls have long shown this is the case. Now the only poll that matters has confirmed it, with a record number of people voting for candidates who support a substantial increase to Centrelink payments. The Greens' record result shows that voters do not fear their initiatives to guarantee a livable income above the Henderson poverty line. So, I mean, do you take encouragement of that, even if the Greens are now not going to end up on that crossbench? What's your hope levels for this new parliament when it comes to doing something about these payments?
Yeah. If I'm trying to find something positive to say, what I would say about this result is it's not going to lead to, hopefully, I presume, an internal shit fight in the Greens about whether being ambitious is politically palatable.
Yes.
So I hope, I expect that the outcome means the Greens will not go backwards and try to follow the small target strategy of other parties. So I guess that's a positive.
Yep.
The way that mainstream politicians are reading this result is going to be that we need to go door knocking too.
Yep.
Like the Greens just did door knocking. We've seen so much in the media like attempting to conflate what happened with the new green seats, with what happened with the teal seats, when they're just worlds apart in terms of what were the drivers and also what the offering was from the Greens versus the teal independents. They're just, as they always do, drastically oversimplifying what has happened and failed to understand what people really think. And I guess, you know, the election result, as I said, confirmed what we already knew. And I guess that's one reason I have no hope, is because politicians already knew this. One of the things I said throughout the election campaign is giving people a livable payment is not an election losing policy. There are a lot of people who won't change their vote just on the welfare policy, right?
Yep.
They won't vote for you because you have a good one necessarily, but they won't not vote for you because you want people to be able to fucking live. So that was so clear. And like one of the polls, which was particularly useful, was a poll that had five Liberal-held marginal seats with extremely high support. I can't quite remember off the top of my head. I think it was something like, you know, 59 to 74% support across those five seats for lifting the payment up to the ACOS Piss Week poverty line, which is still an awful lot higher where the payment is now. And there was also in that, there were a group of people who were polled about whether they would change their vote on that basis. And there were people who said yes. Those were Liberal-held seats. Those included seats where the Teals won. So, yeah, I guess like my view is that politicians don't care what people think. And so they won't actually do anything on that basis. As I said, they already know all this shit.
Well, that's a good attitude to have. No, they care about power. Yeah, they actually care about power.
All this shit. It's nothing new. Yeah. Proved is that it's not an election losing policy, which again, I mean, anyone who actually paid attention to what people think would have already known.
Did you have much luck with the Teals? I mean, we've talked a lot about the Teals on the show, but like our big concern is, of course, that they are, you know, Liberals, they're fiscal conservatives. Someone like Allegra Spender is out there talking about increasing the GST and cutting business taxes. And, you know, as far as I know, pretty much all of them back in the stage three tax cuts. These are not class warriors by any stretch of the imagination. But I don't know, maybe Zali Steggles talked about she supports an increase of job seeker. Have you had much luck with that?
We've managed to hear from or meet with a few of the, both Zali and a few of the new independents. There is a very broad range there. I don't think we've heard from Allegra Spender. It's also with David Pocock is in the mix on this too, right? Important to pay attention to what's the independents in the Senate as well. There's actually far better positions on this in the Senate. Like I can't quite remember Jackie Lambie's position specifically, but I'm pretty sure Jackie would support an increase. We've got David Pocock in there who had one line on his website that was, you know, increase payments to the poverty line or a livable level, some generic phrase. I don't think that means he's currently in support of the livable income guarantee Greens policy, but we'll be working on that. We have had engagement from Monique Ryan's office and from Zoe Daniels' office. And I think that my perspective on the Teals is that some of them may be open to responding to evidence. And as I said, there's an awful lot of evidence about what is needed. They are economic conservatives. People argue with me about my use of the term conservative for these people, but no, it is conservative to care about, like, you know, economics over people. However, when you have to play on their turf, there's great economic benefits to ensuring that people in the lowest incomes have enough to live. So there's no argument against this, right? Other than you have an ideological view that poor people should be punished. And what I would say about the new independents is they are progressive women who like to think of themselves as good people. And I think that there is something, you know, there is the possibility to work with that.
That's damning with faint praise, but yes, go on. Yeah.
Ability to work with that. So yeah, we've got more to do on that front. We'll be aiming to meet with all of them and to engage with them over the life of the parliament. So that if we do end up in the next parliament with a minority government, where those independents are important, they'll understand why this matters. I think it'll be a little bit like climate change, where they'll never go as far as the Greens because they don't want to be associated with the Greens on any level. But I think at least we'll be able to get them to a position where they do understand the need, urgent need, for a much higher payment rate. Not that any of it will matter, because the Labor government is just going to go to the Liberals for votes. I mean, they have the same policies on this. So,
Jesus. All right, let's very quickly. Very. The hope is dying. We're 3 weeks in. The hope is dead. Let's quickly go through. I mean, the big story this week, of course, was the announcing of the cabinet and the swearing in of the Albanese government cabinet. And I'll run through some of these and then really want to focus on the ones that are most relevant to your work and the conversation we're having here. Jim Chalmers as treasurer, big money man, of course, no surprise. Anne Ali is the Minister for Early Childhood and Minister for Youth. She's aged 55, once again, the Minister for Youth. I think it was Richard Colbeck who was also the Minister for Aged Care or whatever last time and was in his late 60s, I think. Chris Bowen, Minister for Climate Change and Energy, no surprise there. Now, Jason Clare moved to education. Tanya Plibersek moved to environment and water. This is quite bizarre because Tanya Plibersek has held the education portfolio for a very long time. My understanding is that she's a very popular person amongst the Australian public. People like Tanya Plibersek.
But who knows why, but yes.
Okay, yes. Not Christine O'Connell, but, you know, broadly speaking.
My nemesis.
And Jason Clare was the housing dude, and now he's moved into education. What did you do? You think there's anything in that, or do you care much about who gets what portfolio here, or like what do you think's going on there?
I think everyone's trying to read the tea leaves, and it doesn't matter because, these people will shuffle around, but the policies aren't going to change. So sure. Doesn't make a difference. Maybe they're all vaguely competent, but yeah, who cares?
Yeah, no, totally fair enough. And we won't spend too long on this.
I mean, I do care on a level. Like, I am paying attention to this, but like, it's hard to see how all of those shuffles, all they reflect is internal machinations and internal politics within the Labor Party, which has never benefited anyone.
Sure.
That's all it means, right?
I think it there's something about like emphasis or priorities. So, for example, Julie Collins has become the Minister for Housing, Homelessness and Small Business. Now,
who the fuck's that?
Exactly. I have no idea who she is. I didn't even follow her on Twitter, and I'm a political hack who like loves all this shit. Didn't follow her. She's from Tasmania, and good luck to her. And like, that's fantastic. Mm. But like, Jason Clare was the housing guy. Housing was, we are in a housing crisis in this country. It was front and foremost an election issue. They've got to deliver on their, very paltry public, social housing commitments. It's going to be shit. Yeah. The joke of a policy. It's a big deal. And then this person that we didn't hear from at all and haven't heard, she's been in the parliament for a long time, I think, but she's in quite a safe seat of Franklin. But it's just like, okay, Julie Collins, I guess we'll see what she has to say about all that. Fine.
Yeah. I mean, I imagine she'll be good at rhetoric just because housing in Tasmania is even more acute in terms of the problems at the moment. And
sure.
The state Liberal government in Tasmania has paid lip service to doing stuff on housing, and their housing policy is not good, but it is actually better than most states. So, like, there's that. But, clearly she's not a heavy hitter.
Sure. Tony Burke is employment and arts. So he doesn't deal with employment services, right? That's all in social services.
That's how
is
it
that
works.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, incredible. So the employment minister isn't in charge of getting people jobs. He just deals with the people who already have jobs. Is that right?
He is the person. He's the relevant minister for employment services, which is the system that people are forced to interact with if they are getting an unemployment payment. Some people on the disability support pension are forced to engage with this, even though they've already been deemed by the government to have many barriers to work. But yeah, so Tony Burke will be one of the people that we're trying to get in the door with and talk to. Again, the little bit of interviews I've heard with him so far are not promising. So he'll be the person kind of bringing in this grand employment summit that they're planning so that they can deliver a white paper so that I guess in a decade they can implement some minor reform if they happen to still be in government. Who knows how fucking long it's going to take them to do this white paper. They have this grand vision of producing a whole lot of words that will mean nothing. So he'll be in charge of that. And so far they haven't chosen to include unemployed people in that.
Because remember when they announced they were going to do a full employment white paper. So is the business – you do the business summit first and then that leads to the full employment white paper, which should then lay out the vision as to how we can get back to full employment. Is that the general idea?
Look, I don't know. I would say I reckon the white paper is going to be an excuse for not returning to full employment.
Oh, okay. We did a white paper and we decided we're not going to have full employment.
We did a white paper that showed actually everything was good and working and we don't need to do big changes. Okay. So the idea is that the summit, they get everyone together, they say some words, then a white paper is written. who knows, maybe they've already written the fucking white paper and it's all a PR exercise. Tony Burke's rhetoric on this so far has been that the government is going to come to the table with ideas, and that's the difference between them and the last government who held summits between unions and employers. But, you know, there's been all this talk about we need the Accords to come back. And as we've seen, the Accords turned out to be fantastic for workers. So I think that the outcome is going to be excellent.
Amanda Rishworth is now the Minister for Social Services. It was formerly Linda Burney when they were in opposition. So Linda Burney's, I guess, focused on Indigenous affairs and voice to parliament stuff and has moved out of that portfolio. Bill Shorten is Minister for NDIS and Government Services. Justine Elliott is the Assistant Minister for Social Services. So there's with Tony Burke, employment, Amanda Rishworth, Bill Shorten and Justine Elliott, I guess those will be your best friends that you'll be focused on.
A great cast of characters, all from the Labor right.
All from the Labor right, of course.
All from the Labor right.
And some of them from the SDA. Who's from the SDA? Is Tony Burke
Amanda
from the SDA?
Rishworth.
Amanda Rishworth.
Amanda Rishworth. I don't actually know about Tony Burke, his pre-parliament background, but I did learn this week that he takes a guitar with him every travel, all of his travel takes a guitar, and that they are currently rearranging his offices to fit a keyboard in because unemployed people are being fucked over and these are his priorities. So, Yeah, I don't know what he did before, but this is something he's played. I guess that's why he has the arts portfolio, because he likes to play keyboard. Those are the people we'll be trying to engage with. All of it is pretty grim. Amanda Rishworth, as you were sort of mentioning with the person who's now got the housing portfolio, Julie Collins, is, again, someone who's kind of been invisible. I think that's useful for them because Anne Rustin, not to the same extent as Michaela Cash, but Anne Rustin was a pretty useful villain, and she was a bit of a lightning rod for dumb things that got a lot of attention. Mm-hmm. Having someone who no one's heard of and doesn't pay attention to and who clearly hasn't made an effort to become a media performer is probably useful for a government that talks a lot about inequality and working families but is not going to do anything to help people on the lowest incomes. The assistant minister is particularly concerning to me. Justine Elliott spearheaded a huge scare campaign telling age pensioners they were going to end up on the cashless debit card, which is a horrible program, but it was utter bullshit. It was never going to happen. The Coalition are not going to put 3 million pensioners on a card that would mean they all vote Labor. That was never going to happen. And what it really did was it made the people who have had their lives destroyed by the card invisible. So I'm not, and I also was very, very, very vocal in my criticism of that campaign. It's going to be awfully hard for us to get her to talk to us. I don't think she will. She also spread a lot of electoral misinformation. So it's not good. It's not good.
Bad news. We should say that at the moment, Janet Rice, the Victorian senator, is the current spokesperson on community affairs. But obviously with this new expanded Greens party room, portfolios and stuff will be divvied up, and you'll find new people moving to new positions. There's a bit of a process that the party goes through before you start allocating all those. And, of course, people might be familiar that Greens MPs tend to have about 8 or 15 portfolios that they talk about. That'll be slightly less. And different MPs will have more things that they can a smaller number of things they can focus on, which is good news. But I suppose, look, some people might be saying that we're being very negative. If you're a Labor drip, you'll be listening to this saying, they've only been in government for a week. Just chill out. You'll be pleasantly surprised. Good things are coming down the pipeline. First of all, like, yes, do you see much reason to hope or like possibility, political possibilities for those of us in the Greens or in the broader movement who want a better deal and want to end poverty in this fucking country to pressure this government, such as it is, to move on these social justice, these economic justice issues? And, you know, I mean, are there some things we can point to, a Royal Commission into robo-debt, for example, that might actually, you know, slightly change the dial in some way? What do you think? And don't feel like you have to be positive just to not bum us out.
I mean, I think there's been a lot of homogenizing of the Greens and Independents, but what will happen is that the government will, in my view, is my prediction, on a lot of things that the Labor Party has the same policies as Liberals, and that is by design. During the election, every time the Coalition announced something within a day, Labor was able to change their policy to reflect whatever the government had said. Although what they did tell us is it was impossible to change the Social Security policy because they already had one. So it's depending on how combative Peter Dutton decides to be and whether he chooses the political strategy of we were very constructive and that's why you should vote us in next time, or whether he chooses Tony Abbott's strategy, which might be where he's going. they're going to, I think, be able to rely on the Libs for a lot of the worst policies. So particularly around Social Security, they are on the same page. Where it comes to things is a bit more grey. So, for example, climate change, where they're unlikely to get support from the Libs, I think that they will seek to and very easily be able to work with independents in the lower house, and they will be able to fully ignore and sideline the Greens. I don't think it's going to be very likely that the Greens are really getting a chance to influence things. And then there's this whole process where if the Greens want to change things in the Senate, that creates a whole lot of extra work and bureaucracy, which is really easy for the Labor Party to paint as being obstructive. So, you know, and obviously that's something that they've continued to talk about, the CPRS, and ignore the existence of the Gillard government for a decade, more than a decade now. Well, a decade. So I don't think there's going to be a lot of broad opportunity for the Greens to do much. I think specifically in Social Security, it is going to be, if anything changes, it will be because the Labor Party has been shamed into it. And so it may be possible for the Labor Party to scapegoat the Greens and say, we didn't want to help poor people. We didn't want to spend the money, but the Greens bullied us into it. So maybe that is the most optimistic, you know, they wouldn't vote for this other thing we had to do. They wouldn't vote for this other thing we had to do unless we gave them this $10 a week increase on Social Security. And so we did that to get them to do this other thing, but it's the Greens' fault that we're going to have more debt. That is like the most optimistic thing I could paint, but I don't have high hopes for that either. As I said, I think it'll be them being shamed into it. I think whatever increase, if they do ever bring one in, it will be outstripped far and away by inflation and the changes in the poverty line. The things that we'll be pushing for, I think a Robert Royal Commission will be deliver some useful information that former government sought to obstruct. And aside from that, I think it's politically useless in terms of actual anti-poverty campaigning. It's people view it as a past issue where it was an injustice, but it's kind of resolved now and it's okay, there's news about it, but what's that going to change? The Labor Party has already, like they've already supported, Bill Shorten's already supported the settlement was gross, right? It basically was them being able to say that they've had a win in terms of the class action that was brought against the government to try and get some compensation for robo-debt victims. It went nowhere and a lot of people felt very sold out by that process. And again, just fueling disillusionment for people who are already being kicked repeatedly. So I think that what I would prefer to see, and again, like hopefully the, you know, we haven't yet had a chance to properly brief either the Greens or Labor or the Independents on our approach that we want to see for debt collection, but maybe something that can be pushed for as a result of the findings of the Robo-Debt Royal Commission would be a Centrelink process that actually focuses on ensuring people have received the correct payment so that they are identifying administrative errors rather than seeking to punish and recoup money from people on low incomes. So a system that actually says, we didn't pay you correctly, we're back paying you. You got a bit of a bonus. Yeah. And you actually, we've found an error with how we calculated your payment, which is always what it is. People are not committing fraud. Mm. We need you to pay it back. But you can do that when you have a decent income, and we'll work with the tax office the same way we do for HECS.
Right.
Once you hit a certain HECS level, income level, your HECS starts to come out of your tax, exactly the same for Centrelink debts. That's how it should work. It should be that simple. So that's the kind of thing we'd like to see long term rather than, you know, a Royal Commission is not an end of itself.
Yeah.
And I,
we keep this money from you when you get a job, which is our responsibility as a government to get you a job to live a decent life in this society. Yeah. That's not your personal failing. That's because of the economic system that we live under, that you're unemployed, there aren't enough jobs.
Yeah. I think we should also just not fetishize full employment either, because right now, we have very small, very low unemployment.
Yes.
And what that means is a lot of disabled people are being bullied into unsafe jobs. So there are real risks with full employment policy. It actually, in my view, another risk with it is that it absolutely gives the government justification for unlivable payments. Some of the people behind this employment summit have the view that you cannot have generous Social Security payments because it means that people can't be forced into work that they don't want to do. Rather than taking the view that if you make jobs really good, people will do them because even living on the poverty line is not that great. so I think it's going to be potentially very bad for welfare recipients if there is this push and this public narrative around full employment, because it just means we have full employment. So if you aren't working, that's a you problem. You are choosing not to have a job, and it is an individual failing. Instead of, you know, talking about, well, a lot of people are pursuing doing work that doesn't have steady income. If you're an artist, for example, you should just be able to go and write a novel or do your creative practice, having a livable level so that when that work may start to generate income for you, you will move off payments, but that you aren't starving yourself in the meantime, or, which is much more common, not doing your creative practice because you have to go and work an unsafe hospitality job where you don't even get minimum wage because they pay you in cash. So, you know, this is the kind of system that I fear if we keep pushing the narrative of full employment. I'd love there to be more jobs and enough jobs for everyone who wants one, but I think the framing is crucial.
Well, if you want to play along to the disappointment with this new government, you can check out the Australian Unemployed Workers Union Welfare Excuse Bingo Card. We'll put a link through in the show notes. Cross them off as you hear them. We need to do a review first. The debt, there are other payments. You'll still be better off with us than Dutton. There are jobs, budget repair, dignity of work. We'll get wedged, et cetera, et cetera. Feel free to enjoy that. If nothing else, then feel free to play along and turn it into a little game for yourself.
Won't take long to get bingo.
The Greens have four seats in the lower house. Yes. Three of those they won.
It's very unfortunate, isn't it?
If it's not with Tabo Clancy.
All right, look, we've spent so much time on this, and as we rightly should have done, we have a small amount of time to hang shit on the new leaders of the coalition. Peter Craig Dutton has been elected unopposed as leader of the Liberal Party, and you've got David Littleproud's middle name, but he is now elected as the new leader of the Nationals. We talked about one of the great moments in Dutton history, in which he suggested that there should be two songs played at the grand final about same-sex marriage. But look, to put it simply, the guy's a cunt. Boycotted the apology to the Stolen Generations, terrified people about African gangs in Melbourne. He said that the Fraser government made some mistakes by settling Lebanese migrants in this country, called Samantha Maiden a mad fucking witch and texted it to her, which, to be fair, was pretty funny. She doesn't seem too fussed about it. He was voted the worst health minister of the past 35 years by doctors. He cut hospital funding when he was in their portfolio. He sued Shane Bazzi for defamation when Shane Bazzi correctly labelled him a rape apologist. He then eventually lost that defamation case, but did take the time to say that there should be publicly funded legal funds so that politicians can sue members of the public for defaming them as part of their job. He said that refugee women were claiming to have been raped in order to get access to the country. He called the Mugarupan family, the Biloela family, referred to the kids as anchor babies. He hates the Greens. When he was asked about the Greens having four members in the lower house, he said, "It's very unfortunate, isn't it?" I forgot about this one in researching in relation to the Greens. Denied that Wilson Security was spying on Sarah Hanson-Young when she was on Nauru, called her an embarrassment to the country, said she was almost certainly lying. Turns out that's exactly what was happening. A private security company was spying on an Australian senator because she'd been critical of the offshore detention regime, was spying on her in her hotel room and such, and Dutton never corrected the record or apologized and just sort of said, that's what's going to happen if you run these torture camps. You know, you gotta get spied on if you go visit them. That's the way that that it works out. And another one I forgot about too, in the wake of the Christchurch shootings, Peter Dutton called Greens leader Richard Di Natale as bad as Fraser Anning by pointing to Dutton's comments about Lebanese migrants. So he's racist. Richard Di Natale points out Peter Dutton's racist bullshit about Lebanese migrants, and Dutton says, "You're as bad as Fraser Anning, who is a white supremacist and basically a fascist who made his horrific comments about the Christchurch shooting, implying that the Muslim community brought this upon themselves."
Also referred to a final solution in his maiden speech to Parliament.
And final solution as a maiden speech, yes. Fraser Anning, extremely bad. Richard Di Natale is not the other side of that coin, for fuck's sake.
Well, if you go actually extremely bad and extremely good, he is the other side of the coin.
Okay, yes, he's the opposite. There you go. has advocated for people who protest climate change to lose their welfare payments. Borderline fascisty. I mean, fascist on a bunch of other fronts, I think it's fair to say, but saying stuff like that, anyone who is out there protesting against the climate crisis and the political classes and the ruling classes' inability to do anything about it should lose their welfare payments, presumably to then
starve and die.
They're already doing that on welfare payments, so it's actually just an extension of existing policy.
I guess, yeah, it's just accelerationist, I guess, on that front. So that's fucked. What do you think of Little Proud when it comes to welfare? He loves to shit on the lazy poor, is that right?
That's right. He loves to roll out the dole bludger bashing. So one of the great things we saw throughout 2020 was obviously an awful lot of harvest work not being done because all of the migrants that we normally exploit in horrifying, unsafe conditions and well below minimum wage wages weren't here to go and pick all the fruit. And so we saw David Littleproud and many others wheel out the line that people on the JobSeeker payment were just lazy, and that the reason people couldn't get their fruit and vegetables or the prices were going up was because people were, not doing anything. And I mean, I could talk forever about all of the barriers to unemployed people actually going to do seasonal harvest labour, but is regularly rolls out that line that the poor are to blame for the price of your vegetables and your groceries. So, and that's not just him. I mean, Ann Rustin was doing it. Scott Morrison was doing it, but he absolutely loves it. And he regularly just sends out a media release that seems to get published verbatim, even in the ABC. So, you know, it's not going to be fun having him and Dutton, you know, this type of welfare bashing, I think, is going to remain, especially because Albanese is choosing to foreground welfare in his rhetoric, which is inviting them to talk about their views on people who aren't in well-paid work. It's also pretty interesting that he actually thinks people on welfare can afford to get to a climate protest and actually spend their time and energy doing that while they're on the hamster wheel of the punitive mutual obligation system. He obviously hasn't met anyone on welfare or a climate protester.
Yeah, clearly not. Little Proud is a former banker, by the way. So we've got a former Queensland cop and a banker heading up the coalition. Little Proud joined the Nationals at 6 years old. Who are these fucking freaks joining political parties when their little kid is?
I'm sorry, that's child abuse. Like, that is not a choice that a six-year-old made. Oh, my God.
So these are horrible people and they're bad and they're going to say bad things and they're going to advocate for bad things. But I suppose, do you find any comfort in this? I mean, I'm much more inclined to be glad that this is where the coalition is heading. I think the shit is unelectable. I think that they're not learning the lessons whatsoever. I think that Dutton will not connect with the Australian people in any way. And I think by lurching further to the right and going harder on these issues, like on these culture war shit, he's immediately pivoting to. I can't see it being a winning strategy of them to gain ground that they've previously lost or find new ways into the suburbs with these kind of tactics. I don't know. I think it's probably pretty good for the left. What do you think?
I think Peter Dutton is vicious and smart, and I think that Australia has shown that this stuff is electable. I mean, if he does return to the Abbott strategy of, again, people just listen, they hear the messaging and they absorb it. And if the messaging is the Labor government is irresponsible, regardless of what's happening, people will hear that. And I think, again, if the Labor Party doesn't deliver on anything that actually helps people, it's not a conscious decision to go, Labor didn't help me, and so I'm open to this negative messaging about them. That is an unconscious process that happens when you are consistently exposed to this kind of stuff. So I think that the Labor Party are pretty inept. I think that they're not going to do a whole lot. I think maybe the childcare policy, if they actually deliver on that, could be enough to keep people on the Labor Party's side. But if they don't make meaningful change in people's lives and they don't make significant progress on climate change, it'll be very easy for Peter Dutton to make people feel really negative about the Albanese government. So, yeah, I definitely...
Even if he's sort of saying he's not backing the 43% emissions reductions target, Little Proud has said basically, you know, we're not on board with net zero anymore. That's that we don't care about that. Yeah. Like, don't you think the climate result from the election is pretty clear? And if they're seriously trying to campaign against that, they're going to fuck themselves over?
Again, it's so hard to, look into the future on this stuff because there are lots of different things in the mix. And I'm going to assume that we're going to have a lot more natural disasters between now and the next election. But if you were the coalition wanting to neutralise this issue, I just think you wouldn't talk about it. If the Labor Party passes some relatively unambitious target or even an ambitious one, unless you're willing to go on the attack to say they've done too much on climate change, it's going to be really hard. So you just get cut through on saying they're irresponsible, they're bad managers. The economy is about to fall into a total shit show. Yeah. You know, people will hear they're irresponsible managers. And those things are largely beyond, you know, the scope of government. They talk an awful lot about inflation. Those things are happening beyond, you know, the borders constructed around this continent by colonizers. You know, that is not something that is at the moment being driven by wages. That's the excuse being given to keep wages down, to keep unemployment payments down, to keep other welfare payments down. But it's really easy when people are having a bad time to tell them it's because the people in charge are hurting them. So I definitely wouldn't say I'd put money on Labor losing government in 3 years. I still think it's more likely they will retain government than not. But I certainly don't think that that is going to be in the bag for them. And I think there's lots of ways they can fuck up, and there's lots of ways the coalition could play it smart.
You're right.
Swimming holes, catching fireflies in jars. Spend the evening staring at the stars.
If you're into free speech, then presumably there'd be two songs played.
Then the gays got married, and the plant shut down, and the crops dried up everywhere around.
You are, Bubba, but you're very smart and you know so much about this stuff, and it's been a pleasure having you on the show. Thank you very much, Kristen O'Connell. Do you have something that you want to point people towards for our call to action? What can people do to make this country slightly less fucked for people on welfare, or something that's really taking your fancy of late?
Yeah, this is something really minor, and it's as in my like a low level ask. But I think it's very longer term useful. There is brilliant person that I know down in Melbourne called Holly Jones, who is running a survey at the moment about mold. And I know that lots and lots and lots of people who listen to this podcast care about the state of housing. And mold is a big problem right now for lots of us who are experiencing a lot of rain. And that's really important work, because renters' rights are appalling, and we need some weapons in the toolkit to be able to say this is the kind of change people need just to stop destroying their lungs by living in unsafe housing. So I would say to everyone, go and fill out the mold survey. I have put a bit of a challenge out to people to see who can do the funniest or best take in the final optional question. So please have fun with the final optional question that just says, do you have anything else to add? Someone put a great one, which was job seekers should be paid in mold. Which would be fantastic, right? Because there's so much mold around. It would just be like raining in money. There's a lot of things people can do to support campaigns around rights for welfare recipients at the moment. Mm-hmm. So I would say follow the Unemployed Workers Union, follow our work at the Anti-Poverty Centre. We're on all social media, but we're really mostly active on Twitter. Sign up to our statements and keep across what is going on, because it's something that the government will attempt to not have anyone paying attention to. So we need as many voices as possible keeping pressure on, and we'll be rolling out strategies to target every individual member of government and the crossbench over the next 3 years.
Amazing. We'll put those links in the show notes for you.
Mold survey.
Mold survey, obviously very important. And check out the Anti-Poverty Centre and Australian Unemployed Workers Union. Very quick plug for me. Remember, next weekend is National Conference for the Greens. Serious Danger is going to be there live on the Sunday afternoon. It's just going to be me, of course. Emerald's still on holidays. That's going to be super fun. So if you're going along to National Conference, we'd love to see you there at 4 p.m. on the Sunday afternoon at Trades Hall. And we'll report back on the show about the stuff that went down at National Conference. I assume it's mostly people having drugs and fucking each other and celebrating the election victory. So you look forward to that.
That would be a much better national conference.
Oh, is that not what happens? Okay, goddamn.
I'm sorry. Again, I'm a downer.
Bye with everyone. Thanks so much for doing this, Kristen. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me again.
Rate and review this show on Apple Podcasts. Give us a 5-star review. Become a patron at patreon.com/seriousdangerau. Follow us on social media too, seriousdangerau. We're on Twitter, Instagram. If you're watching this on YouTube, like and subscribe. Much obliged. You can email us anytime. hello@seriousdangerpod.com. Bye, everyone.
Serious Danger, Australia.